real-time check-in with today's business world and more. This is the Wintrust Business Lunch, sponsored by Wintrust, Chicago's bank, on 720 WGN. Here's Steve Bertrand.
And welcome to Thursday afternoon, everyone. This is the Wintrust Business Lunch. A little later in the program, we'll talk to Ian Scher. He's an executive editor at CNET.com. And, you know, we always check in with Ian about what's going on with the scooters in San Francisco. And there's more on that there. Mary Wisniewski is in the studio now. She writes about transportation for the Chicago Tribune. Mary, welcome.
Thank you.
You know, I don't know if you know about the scooter store in San Francisco, right? Dockless. And there's a Dockless program now in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
Have you covered much of that?
I have, yeah.
How's it going?
So far, I hear it's very popular that people are trying them out, and they're trying both the electric and the non-electric versions. The electric can be pretty fun once you get used to them, especially for hills and headwinds.
And in Chicago, the ordinance says you have to attach them to something when you're done, right?
Well, they'll have to. All of them will have to be attached to something by July 1st.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so, and right now, most of them have to be attached to something.
So we're not seeing the, like, scooter litter like they're seeing in San Francisco?
Not yet.
Because we're more civilized people.
Well, it's difficult to take those big electric bikes and throw them somewhere. That's part of the problem.
You wrote a few stories that kind of have me geeked out. I love these stories you've written about cars and traffic fatalities. Because, you know, I mentioned a little bit to Bill and Wendy about, we tend to think, you know, oh, it's such a dangerous time. So many people are dying on the roads. Historically, we're at a pretty low rate when it comes to traffic fatalities. I mean, there was things 34,000 in 2016, 34,000 and some. And as recently as in the early 70s, there were 52,000 people dying on the road.
Right. It used to be a much more dangerous enterprise to get on the roads. You didn't have seat belts. You didn't have anti-lock brakes. You didn't have some of the road structures that we have now that make things easier to drive. And so, yeah, if you were, you know, in the 30s and the 40s, there were a lot more traffic deaths. But safety experts believe they could be a lot lower even then, now.
And so there was this study from the International Transport Forum, which looked at 29 countries, and the U.S. was one of a few countries where the fatalities actually are ticking up.
They are. It's the country where the percentage has gone up the most between 2010 and 2016. It was 13.5%. And one of the authors of the study who I talked to, this was I was in Leipzig last week, he said that distracted driving is a big, big problem in the United States. And also just that there are more cars on the road because the economy's been better. So people are going to work and driving their cars. And that means there's more potential for conflict.
So there are more people out there. More.
Right.
Now, I understand that about the distracted driving. We like to talk about that all the time. But the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, you also write, says the number of crashes due to texting or talking on mobile devices actually dropped in 2016.
It did, but it's kind of a curious number. I talked to Derek Kahn, who was with the U.S. Department of Transportation. And they're looking actually at whether there might be a problem with the number, whether it's being measured correctly.
Because everyone's doing it.
Because everyone's doing it, and it's not always reported after there's a crash distracted driving could have been a factor. So there has to be more standardization in how this is reported.
When it comes to looking across the world or around the world, we have a problem with pedestrian deaths too.
Right.
Those numbers went up. It was more than 30%.
Right. And cyclist deaths have also gone up, and some of that is because cycling is very popular. And so if there's more cyclists on the road, there's more people that are going to get hit. Pedestrian deaths, it could be there's more people walking, but also it could be there's more people who are distracted both while they're walking and while they're driving.
Okay, let me read you more of your story. You write that during the time period, 39.2%, the highest jump in pedestrian deaths in the U.S. at 39.2%, 34.8% in cyclists. But here's what strikes me. Norway, where I'm going next week,
all right,
saw a 37.5% drop in pedestrian deaths. So what are they doing in Norway that we're not doing here?
Well, one thing about Norway is that it's kind of a small country. So you have to take into consideration that when you have smaller numbers, you know, things can go up and down more easily. But it's good to look at some of the other countries that have lower numbers. And some of what's going on is in countries like Sweden, you have the program called Vision Zero, which we have here in Chicago for the last year, but they've had in Sweden for two decades where they've really taken a look at what causes fatal crashes and tried to address these issues.
And this is big, right? This is they're rebuilding roads and everything.
They're rebuilding infrastructure. They're adding more automated speed cameras because a big factor is speed. It's kind of like the silver bullet
right.
in crashes. If someone hits you at 25 miles an hour, you're going to live. Oh, maybe. If someone hits you at 50, you're not.
One other statistic then, 19% of Americans live in rural regions, but that's where the traffic fatalities are.
That's right. And some of that is infrastructure. Some of that is if you're going down a rural road, there's not a lot of lights. There might not be a clear center line, and there might not be good speed restrictions. And so all of those things can play into
I grew up in
this.
Farm country, and my son now goes to school in rural Ohio. So we're driving through cornfields, and I'm like, Noah, you have to look when you come upon these four-way intersections in cornfields, people can't see each other. And
right.
I remember people just, horrific crashes there.
Big factor is trees, strangely enough. That's people not expecting, a tree to be, where they don't, and people veering off the road for
and
some reason
trees.
Hitting a tree.
Because they're moving at higher speeds,
right.
too. Okay, let's talk about this opioid story you wrote as well, because it's fascinating, the idea that more and more crashes are drug-related. I said mm-hmm. opioid, but really drug-related. And the catch is, it's not an easy thing to prosecute
right.
or to even discourage.
Right. Well, some people think that they drive better when they're smoking marijuana.
But you even said in this piece that some people maybe do.
And some people, chronic users, people who may not have a high level of impairment. And so that's one problem.
That's a terrible thing. That makes it impossible to talk people out of it if...
But there have been multiple studies that show that, marijuana impacts things that make you a good driver. It might make you sleepy. It might make you, have time, spatial relation distortions. And so there is evidence that, marijuana is not such a good idea when you're driving. Opioids are not a good idea. And so this study is encouraging states to, let's talk about this the way we're talking about drunk driving.
So if there's a fatal crash, it's more likely to be, there's more likely to be drugs involved than alcohol.
Right, by a little bit. Not a lot. Alcohol is still a big, big thing, but it has dropped just a bit as a factor in fatal crashes. And the safety expert I talked to, Dr. Jim Hedlund, said that one reason for this is that the anti-alcohol campaign is working.
Mm-hmm.
There's a big stigma on drunk driving now. You don't say, let's have one for the road anymore.
That's funny, isn't it? That's a phrase that's just gone.
Yeah.
So alcohol deaths are going down.
A little bit.
While drug mm-hmm. deaths are tending to go up.
Right.
Problem is you can give a blood alcohol test pretty quickly or a blow, but you can't do that with drugs.
No, it's really hard to measure with marijuana because there's really only a blood test, and a blood test is often taken hours after someone is arrested, and the amount of THC in your blood can go down quite a bit in a short amount of time. And also, you can still find marijuana in somebody's body for up to a month after they've smoked, so they might not be impaired at all.
And we're just talking about marijuana. Alcohol is alcohol, but mm-hmm. drugs are drugs. There are a lot of different
right.
things in there that you need to test for.
Well, they are looking right now. There's a test being done on saliva, roadside saliva tests for marijuana in Michigan, and they're also looking at different kinds of breath tests, which aren't out yet, but they're, this report is encouraging states when these tests are available to give them a try.
But this report from the Governor's Highway Safety
Association
mm-hmm. also says that advice is against giving like there's a legal limit for alcohol, and they said that's not a good idea when you're setting a restriction for drugs.
Right, because it's not the same comparison. If you have 0.08% alcohol in your blood, you're drunk. You shouldn't
right,
be driving.
Right.
But if you have 5 nanograms per milliliter of marijuana metabolites in your system, you may not be high.
So how will they ever write a law to prosecute this?
Well, one thing that they look at is other factors that will show you that someone is impaired. Then there's a police safety program that this report is recommending that called Advanced Roadside Impaired Driving Enforcement, and it's a 2-day course to recognize the signs of drug impairment.
I understand that, but so then the officer goes to court and he says, well, I recognize these things.
These different signs.
But it's not the hard evidence of a blood alcohol
yeah,
test.
Yeah, well, if you have those and the blood
crash.
Test
yeah.
and a crash, all of those things together, what the association doesn't want is for them to just rely on blood alcohol levels because it's not enough.
Mary Wojnarowski writes about transportation for the Tribune. Thanks for coming by.
Thanks for having me.
This is the Wintrust Business Lunch with Steve Bertrand, sponsored by Wintrust, Chicago's bank, on 720 WGN.
And here we are in the Allstate Showcase Studio along Michigan Avenue on this Thursday afternoon. Bill Geiger's in the studio. Our regular conversations with Bill are sponsored by Geiger Wealth Management. Welcome back.
Good to be here, sir.
You and I talk about this a lot, and you talk about the happiest people are the ones who come into your office with a pension, right?
Big pensions,
and then you talk about the fact, well, then you can also create with your own assets sort of a pension that's going to keep paying you and things like that.
Here's what happened. They come into my office, they get a big smile on their face because they've got a great pension. But they're constantly looking over their shoulders because there's three big issues going on with pensions. The first is a lot of pensions are underfunded. They don't have the money to keep their promises. Now, they'll never tell you this.
Right.
They'll say they're fully funded, but a lot of them are underfunded, so you have to worry. The second thing is when you retire, you've got to depend upon your ex-employer for the next 20 to 30 years to make good business decisions. Can you imagine depending upon your ex-spouse to do that?
Well, I don't have
for
any
for 20
of those,
to
Bill,
30
but,
years.
But so, you know, I remember a while ago, it seemed sort of common, and you brought up, we were talking about the airlines off the air, where companies were going back and cutting pensions or reducing pensions. How often does that really happen?
It happened to my father.
Really?
My father worked for a company his entire life. He retired, and about 3 years after he retired, the company that he worked for declared bankruptcy for the sole purpose of getting rid of their pension obligations. My father's pension got cut in half, and consequently so did my mother's. And he had no say about that.
And
that's
the company,
just what happened.
The company just went away?
No, the company's still around.
So the company went into bankruptcy
to get rid of the pension
to
obligation.
To hurt the people who worked for it, and then it stuck around.
And they're stuck around. They're still around today.
Wow.
They're still in my hometown that I grew up in. Here, there is a solution to this, though, is if your company offers a lump sum versus your pension, you can use that lump sum to effectively create your own private pension plan for your family. They're safe. You have control for the rest of your life. And when you're gone, when you and your spouse are gone, you actually have some money that you can leave to your family.
So if I've got a pension and I die, my wife would get a portion of it.
That's right. And then when she's gone, that's it.
Right.
That's it. The family gets nothing. But if you create your own plan, you've got something that you can leave as a legacy.
How frequently do companies allow a lump sum like that?
Pretty frequently.
Really?
I mean, we do this all the time, Steve. I mean, maybe once or twice a month, maybe three times a month, we see people come in with exactly that type of issue. And they've got good pensions, but they're really worried about them lasting for the next 20 to 30 years. And it's legitimate.
It's certainly in the news that the state legislature, the House, is probably going to vote on a budget today. And, I mean, we know about the government pension issues. I know they're protected by the Illinois Constitution. Mine aren't.
You know what? When you talk to somebody about their pension, they're very quick to tell you why their pension is different from anybody else's. Oh, it's fine.
Right.
Oh, it's protected by the Illinois Constitution. You don't think that can be changed?
What is the law? Can they just change?
Anybody can change anything if they get enough votes, including the Illinois Constitution.
But I'm talking about private companies. They can just willy-nilly? Or they?
Well, they can declare bankruptcy. And they can put aside their pension obligations. When they do that, what happens is a pension benefit guarantee corp comes in. First thing they do is cut the pension in half.
Right. We've seen that actually in a couple of recent stories. Okay, so the lesson then today is
if you've got a lump sum pension, you can create effectively your own private pension plan. And Steve, I know you're going to talk about this. The next five callers who call in who have at least $500,000, if you've got a lump sum possibility, we'll walk you through this. And again, we do this all the time.
Bill Geiger, thanks for coming by.
Good to see you, sir.
Now, your noontime check-in with today's business world and more. This is the Wintrust Business Lunch, sponsored by Wintrust, Chicago's bank, on 720 WGN. Here's Steve Bertrand.
It's 12:35 on this Thursday afternoon, warm and muggy afternoon, but the weekend's not far away. It's going to be cooler for that as well. A little bit later in the program, Elise Glink will be here. She is, of course, the brains behind ThinkLink.com, BestBuddyMoves.com, and all of that. And one of the things I want to talk to her about is this, you know, we're going to get the jobless report tomorrow. Employers are having a hard time finding workers in some cases. Walmart now is offering to pay for their employees, full or part-time, their college education just for $1 a day. So we'll talk to Elise about that. But first on the phone line is Ian Schur. He's a senior editor for CNET.com and joins us on most Thursdays. Ian, welcome back to the Biz Lunch.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm well, thank you. Okay, so my Uber experience still is fairly limited. I just don't have occasion to use it. I hope to do it a little bit more this summer, going back and forth to Ravinia and places like that. And I think probably, you tell me, but when you look at totality and the millions of rides that they offer, the number of problems that are reported are fairly small, but because it's new and because it's sort of a groundbreaking business, we tend to hear about almost all of the complaints. Having said that, Uber knows they need to do something, and one of the things they're doing is this 911 button. Tell me about that.
Yeah, so, I mean, first off, you know, assaults in these cabs is never okay. And so they're trying to find all of the solutions they can to deal with it. And so one of the things that they've done, as reported on CNET, was to add this 911 button into the app. So now as you're, you know, odds are you have the Uber app on when you get into the into someone's car, and you can just click that little button and it starts 911.
And now, so that calls 911 for you.
Yes, okay. Exactly. And you could say, well, you know, why not just go to the phone and start call 911 yourself? And especially in an emergency situation, right, the least number of actions you have to take to be safe is what's best. And so Uber is kind of realizing this. Now, this isn't the only thing they're doing. They're also upping the way that they do screening of some of their drivers and whatnot. But you can't stop every bad person from driving for Uber. It's just impossible, just like you can't stop every bad person from doing all sorts of jobs, right? And so the best thing that they can do is also help us protect ourselves by having this little button in there.
And I agree with you, obviously. Any single assault is one too many. But when you look at the numbers, it's not an unsafe proposition by and large.
Oh, absolutely. And, I use it quite often. My wife uses it quite often. It's funny because my wife is still uncomfortable sometimes, right? She's not a technophobe, but she is uncomfortable with the idea still of getting in someone's car. And so Uber and Lyft both have this feature where you can actually send your friends a live map of where you are and where the phone and car is at any given time. And so she sends that to me every time she gets into a cab. She'll send me a little thing saying, hey, this is my Lyft. You can follow me along. And it makes her feel comfortable. And that's another feature that it helps her feel good, so it's all good.
That's
right?
Funny. I love that because, you know, there also are spouses or relationships where it's like, are you following me? You can't follow me. Leave me alone.
We're the opposite of that. We actually stalk each other all the time.
Right. Well, that's
but
good.
Helps,
a couple
right?
that stalks. It's better that a couple stalks each other than others.
Right. Well, look, it really helps because when we're driving home, you know, I'm able to know whether she's gotten home before me and I can just be prepared, right? Or if she's still at the office. I know those types of things, and those features are now built into our phones. It's very easy to do, and when it's used responsibly, it's really great.
Yeah, you know, my daughter tracks us, her parents, and so she always knows when we're about to be around. And, I don't mind that at all, I guess, and I track her. She doesn't realize it. Well, she does, but she forgot. Okay, so...
but she knows now.
One other Uber story, though. You and I have been talking about Uber a lot, and one of the stories that we talked about it within the past year or so was their lawsuit, this mano-a-mano fight against Waymo. And now I read in CNET that Uber and Waymo are working together on driverless cars. What's that about?
Yeah, so it's really weird, right? Like this was, Waymo, by the way, is a company that's owned, but used to be part of Google, right? It's owned by Alphabet, which is the holding company of Google. And it is a self-driving car company. And they have been pushing really hard on new technology. But they accused Uber of stealing their technology when Uber was building its self-driving cars.
But there was a guy who switched jobs or something, right, and brought technology
yes,
with him?
Yes, exactly. And so he helped start Uber's self-driving car thing, and then he was accused of stealing Uber Waymo's secrets. So there was this huge lawsuit. There were billions of dollars on the line. It was settled, and now we're hearing that Uber is actually planning to work with Waymo, which is really big. And, you know, the CEO of Uber said, look, this is about making sure the best technology is on the road and safest, which is the best line you can use, right? It's absolutely true. And after Uber had that huge accident a couple of months ago, anything they can do to reassure people is important.
How big of a setback was that accident? I mean, I think something like it was inevitable. We, you know, logically, we have to know these things are going to happen. And yet, I'm assuming it had a pretty big impact on the rollout of all of this.
Yeah, I mean, it had a huge psychic impact on the entire industry. You saw everyone slow down their efforts or pull out entirely. You saw states actually shutting down their efforts around licensing these people or slowing down their efforts and saying, wait a minute, maybe this wasn't a good idea. Because before that, we actually had trucks on the road in Arizona, right. I think it was, in Nevada, that were self-driving trucks on their own in the real world, passing real people. And now that stuff has all been slowed down because of all of this stuff. And so it was a big thing. It needed, you know, this conversation needed to happen, right? It's good that the conversation happened. It's very sad that the person died as a result of that accident. But I think that the end result is that we're all going to live in a safer world when this stuff actually eventually becomes normal.
All right. I want to talk scooters here before we're gone. But before that, 30 seconds or so, I opened up another one of my apps, and it said that their privacy standards have changed or they have an update. And then they asked me to read this. Does anyone read those things?
No, they don't, unfortunately, and they should. But the good news is at CNET, we have this great list of stories under what's called GDPR, General Data Protection Regulation, which is this new law in Europe that kicked in last week. And we have all these stories that explain what you need to know. So at least we can help you there. But no, let's be realistic. Nobody reads these things. That's part of the problem.
Right. And so if you go to CNET, though, there's some explanation of what you should be looking for.
Absolutely.
So Mary Wisniewski was just in the studio. She writes for the Chicago Tribune, and she writes about transportation. We were talking about other things, but I mentioned that I was going to be talking to you today, and I mentioned this Scootermageddon, or whatever they're calling it in San Francisco. You know, we have now dockless rideshare, or not rideshare, but dockless bikes in the city, in some neighborhoods. I think they're on the south side. Some of them are electric bikes. And she said, we really haven't had trouble here like has happened in San Francisco. What is it about? What's going on in San Francisco?
Well, there's a difference. We have dockless. We have docked bikes in San Francisco, but these scooters, three companies came in and just dumped over 1,000 scooters on the road. They're all dockless. People are jerks with them. And so what happens is that you unlock the thing with your phone, and you're able to drive it around. It's a dollar and then 15 cents a mile or something like that, or 15 cents a minute, rather.
Okay.
And you're able to get around. And but people are leaving them everywhere.
But there's a story that people now are sabotaging them?
Yes, and that's part of the problem. So it's caused all of this backlash, and there are people actually pooping on them. Can you believe this? They're breaking them. They're cutting the brake lines. It's incredible. And so we have this great story on CNET about what the companies are doing to solve for this, right? Because now, I mean, that's very dangerous. If you have the brake line caught on one of these things, they can go up to 20 miles an hour. So it's really interesting how the city's dealing with this and what the companies are doing to deal with it.
So who are the bad guys here? I mean, are people on scooters now looked at as scans? I mean, are they sort of, I don't know, like the public smokers? Or what's going on? Are people don't like scooter riders? Or do they ride them anyway and scoff at them behind their backs?
I think everyone's bad in this situation, right? The locals are bad because they're just angry at new ideas. The new idea people are bad because they're being really bad about how they're doing it. And the city is trying to clamp down on this stuff, but they haven't come up with the right answer yet. So everyone's kind of at a loss right now, which is, look, this is part of what it's like, right? I mean, the taxi industry is going through a very similar thing with Uber. They're all angry at each other, right? In South Africa, we wrote a story in CNET about how people are getting killed over Uber driving. And so, you know, it's not happening here in that regard, but the scooter thing happened very suddenly and upset a lot of people. And it's going to be a while before it gets settled.
That's Ian Scher, and senior editor at CNET.com. Ian, anytime you want to come back to the Midwest, we tend to be nicer to each other here.
I'll keep that in mind.
You're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN.
This is the Wintrust Business Minute.
Got a minute? Good, because I've got the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing the news, providing input, and breaking down the stories that matter to the world of business. Well, it's not looking good for Chicago's Amazon hopes. Adam Data Solutions released a study narrowing down the locations for Amazon's HQ2, focusing on housing and quality of life, and Chicago is not near the top. Believe it or not, Raleigh, North Carolina is at the top of the list, with Atlanta coming in second. Some of the other factors included were property taxes, crime rates, medium price for living, and others. But it's a third-party study, so technically it's not official, but they're all definitely going to be important aspects for Amazon wherever they end up. On a more local side of business, the food truck fight with the city continues on. As the industry gains more popularity around the country, the awareness of Chicago's strict food truck regulations are coming to light. The Illinois Supreme Court will hear one of the first cases filed in 2012 against the city to loosen up regulations so business can thrive, because it's no doubt The market is ready, and they're hungry. Tune in tomorrow for all of your up-to-date business news on WGN Radio.
Back to Steve Bertrand and the Wintrust Business Lunch, sponsored by Wintrust, Chicago's bank, on 720 WGN.
It is 12:51 here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks very much for tuning in. John Williams just a few minutes away. But before that, something even better. Elise Glink is on a phone line. She is the person behind ThinkGlink.com, the CEO of Best Money Moves. I don't know if you checked out Best Money Moves yet. It's an HR app that helps businesses work with their employees to sort of figure out their financial stress and then create strategies to sort of deal with that stress. I just call Elise and she helps me deal with my stress just about every week. Welcome back, Elise.
Thank you, Steve.
Okay, so we have a few stories here to talk about. We've got Walmart offering education. There's a story about how students are dropping out because of college debt and all of that. And tomorrow the jobless numbers come out. I'm going to completely befuddle you with my new theory. What if one day we developed a system where corporations drafted students, high school students, the way college or the way the NBA does, Major League Baseball, the way they pick someone with skills and invest in them and then train them and bring them up, rather than having high school kids go on to a college and then try to find a job? What if the corporations end up picking those students at their high school college graduation? They then pay for their college. They pick people based on skills or personalities or things like that, and they train workers the way they want them to be trained. How stupid is that?
Well, I think that's the way it used to work about 50 years ago.
Really?
When very few people went on, very few people went on to college. You had a high school graduate and they would go to work for a company like an auto dealership, or they would go to be a mechanic. They would maybe take some trade school classes, but we didn't have a higher education the way we think about it today for the vast majority of Americans, the way we now imagine it. And so high school was the big, the finishing place. And even in high schools, they used to have more trade kinds of things where you could take a mechanic class, or you could take a class on, I don't know if you could take one in HVAC systems, but it was that similar sort of thing. And I don't think you're crazy to think that. I do think, though, that a lot of the higher technology requirements do require some post-high school classes. So be interesting to see how it changes.
Yeah, my idea would be that you'd be giving these kids, the personality test that exists, or, the skills test that exist, and then say Google would be after a certain number of people who showed these sorts of characteristics, and they would sign them almost to letters of intent at high school graduation and then pay for their college education with the idea that they then would work with Google. They'd be totally Google-fied by the time they got their bachelor's degree.
Well, more and more kids are actually able to accumulate the so-called 10,000 hours of expertise before they actually hit the age of 18 in the tech area. So, in fact, I know of a couple of students who, instead of going to college, actually went to work full-time in the tech industry because they were so good and proficient at what they did, having started by age 6 or 7 or 8 with coding, that by the time they were 18, 10 years later, that they were really able to go and get high-paying jobs, six-figure jobs.
I know a couple of those stories, too. That is a pretty fascinating thing, where you think that the most sort of technical skills can be acquired without a secondary education.
That's right. And you can argue that maybe brains aren't fully developed until your mid-20s. But if you're 18 and somebody's offering you what in Chicago, a median salary for somebody going into the tech world as a coder is somewhere around $70,000 to $80,000 a year, plus benefits, and maybe even free food, that's pretty hard to turn down, especially if that's really what you love. You want to go into that industry, and it's hard to sort of to say to somebody, my brain might benefit from 4 more years of college, but I could be earning, $320,000 or spending $320,000. That's a really big ROI taking a job.
We discourage the kid from shooting hoops all through high school, saying, the chances of being a pro athlete are really, really small, but instead we should be encouraging them to go to coding school on their own, and maybe they could skip college and go right to the draft from there.
Well, certainly they'd have a longer lifespan than in professional sports.
Okay, so those are the successful ones. I should bring up, too, the study I was talking about earlier, this Magnify Money study, found that 39% of students, when it comes to their student loans, would maybe drop out of school because rather than take on more debt. I mean, that's the problem we're facing. So there's that. And then bring Walmart into it. Walmart now offering to pay for college education for full and part-time workers for $1 a day. Does that speak to the fact that they need college-educated workers or that they need to attract workers who are interested in a college education?
I think it's partly the attraction. This is, again, being 18 and you can go to work for Walmart full or part-time. You just have to work there 90 days and then they'll start paying for your college education. It's also about retention. So a lot of times you see companies like Walmart and they have a really big turnover problem. And it can cost a lot of money, like 1 to 1.5 times somebody's salary to attract somebody, train them, bring them in, and all the rest. And so, you know, everybody is struggling right now with not having enough workers. This is a very innovative and smart way, I think, for Walmart to bring people in who probably wouldn't have a shot at being able to pay for college without some sort of outside assistance, getting them in, bringing them along the Walmart way. I will point out, though, that the subsidy can only be used to right. take courses at the University of Florida, Brandman University in Irvine, California, Bellevue University in Bellevue, Nebraska. And those three universities were chosen by Walmart because of their high graduation rates. You can go there in person or you can work for them online. I imagine they're going to find other universities to bring in as part of this as well down the line.
Elise Glink, thanks very much for joining us. Let's do it again next Thursday.
You bet, Steve.